The late, great poet Maya Angelou once said, "I'm always amazed when people walk up to me and say, 'I'm a Christian.' I think, 'Already? You got it? I'm working at it,' which means I try to be as kind and generous and respectful and courteous as I can to every human being." I admire that approach to religion. Perhaps any ideals that we are working toward, we can only be working toward. We cannot perhaps ever fulfill them. And that's why I couch this reflection as being and becoming Unitarian Universalist. Not only are we UUs, those of us who consider ourselves to be, we are also becoming UU, growing into it, continually discovering what it might mean for us. And similar to Maya Angelou's comment about Christianity, the Reverend Dr. Natalie Fenimore, a prominent UU religious educator, quoted Shirley Chisholm. You remember Shirley Chisholm? Who remembers Shirley Chisholm? Okay, some of us go back that far. A few decades back in 1972, Shirley Chisholm, a black woman, ran for U.S. president as a Democrat. And here's what Dr. Fenimore wrote. She said, "Shirley Chisholm was asked why she, a black woman, was running for president. 'You don't have a chance. Why are you doing that?' And she said, 'Because I'm in love with the America that does not yet exist.'" And that's how, Fenimore says, Unitarian Universalism is also. She says, "I'm in love with the Unitarian Universalism that doesn't yet exist. But I have to hold both the love for that thing and the love for the reality. It does not yet exist. It will probably not exist in my lifetime. I don't think it will in that in my children, but I can't deny my love for it. You know, wanting to be there in that struggle, that's why I'm fighting." So, we're growing into our religion, working toward making its values real, and at the same time, helping our religion itself grow into its values, making its values real in the world. You know, there are always two kind of parts of religion that stand in tension to one another. One is that the ideals, and the other is the institutional expression. And they're always in a certain amount of tension with one another. The institutional expression never fully fulfills the ideals. But we have to keep that tension there. So as you use, too, we get to do this because we know religion itself evolves, just as we individual UUs evolve, just as our congregations evolve. And it's really pretty amazing, that evolution. And it's very different from a religion that is trying to maintain its tradition by being frozen in time, which some do. So this month, we're focusing on Unitarian Universalism, what it's about, what it means to be UU. And last week, at least some of you heard three examples of spiritual journeys that gave you some examples of what it means to be UU. Today, I want to talk a little more abstractly and globally. Some religions define themselves in terms of belief. And because Christianity has historically done that, many people in our culture think that religion must be centered in belief, and belief in some fairly narrow categories. What does your church think about Jesus, about heaven and hell, about salvation? But not all religions define themselves that way. As a colleague of mine has often said, churches don't believe anything. People do. So how else does a religion define itself? Think of Judaism. Judaism defines itself as a people. It's an ethnic and cultural tradition knit together with a religion. Most Jews are born into it. You can convert to Judaism, but even conversions usually come because of a marriage or other personal identification with the Jewish people rather than because a set of beliefs. Then there's Islam. Islam is a practice-based religion. The five pillars spell out ways of acting in the world. Making a profession of faith, yes, but offering prayers five times a day, giving zakat or charitable contributions, making a pilgrimage to Mecca, and fasting during the month of the daylight hours in the month of Ramadan. That's five clear actions that define Islam that faithful Muslims practice. Buddhism, too, defines itself in practice. It outlines its major precepts and references to three things you take refuge in: the Buddha, the Dharma, or teachings, and the Sangha, or community. Hinduism is notoriously difficult to define. Its beliefs vary widely. Its practices vary just as widely. Even its gods are different in different places and for different people. It does have some ethnic and cultural connections, as Judaism does, but the more I study Hinduism, the less I can define it. And you might have similar challenge in specifying what brings Unitarian Universalism together. We certainly don't define ourselves in terms of beliefs, as Christianity does. We've long made sure that there's always a conscience clause in any statement that we make of what we're about. But not everybody has to subscribe to this. Perhaps we are a practice-based religion, but we don't make it as simple and clear as Islam does. We don't give five instructions that take care of everything. We do, though, think that what matters is how we live in this life rather than what we believe or working toward another life after this one. So, how we live in this life. I have to begin with what may be our clearest center, covenant, the grounding for how we live in this life. We are a tradition that instead of creed embraces covenant. So what does that mean? We do not spell out beliefs or orthodoxy, but instead come together committing to walk together, to move ahead together. And moving together is an action, if only a metaphorical action. Still, as I mentioned about our continuing evolution, Reverend Louis B. Fisher, who was dean of a Universalist theological school before the Unitarians and Universalists consolidated, once said, "Universalists are often asked to tell where they stand. The only true answer to give to this question is that we do not stand at all. We move." So by claiming a covenantal tradition, we are saying that what matters is not believing alike, but finding a way to move together, a way to live together. And that's harder than it sounds. For me, it means a series of actions, large and small. Abstractly, it means we respect one another. But that results in concrete actions, listening when someone speaks, expressing disagreement without insulting or belittling one other's opinions, giving the benefit of the doubt and offering forgiveness when someone has wronged us. Importantly, though, we also try to call one another to our best selves. So in the case where someone seems to have wronged us, we don't let it slide, but we bring up the issue judiciously and even lovingly. So part of our practice is dialogue, to reach toward truth and understanding, sharing our stories. In fact, I believe that Unitarian Universalism's greatest gift to the world is that at our best, we gather despite differences and find ways to work together and to love one another. We listen and learn from one another, and if the whole world could learn that, then we would indeed build a new Eden. And all of this is based in covenant, in agreeing to be together even when we disagree. So a second practice that may not be readily evident is education. We UUs are fundamentally learners. Admittedly, demographers describe UUs as one of the most highly educated religious groups, but I don't want to focus too much on where people have gone to school or how many degrees they've earned, because not all UUs are college graduates or even deep readers. I do think, though, that to be happy in a UU congregation, one has to be open to learning more about oneself and about the world, whether through reading a book, talking with friends, listening to a podcast. We are seekers of truth. Now, let me test that. How many of you are active learners? Yeah. How many of you are seekers of truth? Yeah, pretty much. That's what I thought. We recognize that our children are learners, too. And we want to make sure there are safe ways for them to explore their world and themselves. And that's why we devote time, energy, and money to their religious education. This morning, we honored three of our graduates, products of a UU religious education program. And having talked with all of them, though they've been involved with this congregation in different ways, I know they have been affected by their connection with a UU congregation. We have shaped the way they view the world, the values they bring to it, and the way they live their lives. The Channing reading that we shared as a responsive reading earlier, though it was written in the 19th century, it still reflects the values we bring to raising our children. Now, Sandy and I have had ongoing conversation about our goals in religious education. And though we're committed to Unitarian Universalism and hope our children understand UUism as an option for them, our religious education program is not about creating UUs necessarily. Rather, it is about inculcating values and equipping them to be thoughtful, loving people, able to balance independence and interdependence, and to be vital members of a community. So I guess we're trying to teach them how to live. Unitarian Universalists, for at least a couple of centuries, have been foremost among progressive educators, trusting children to learn not through rote memorization, but by developing their ability to think for themselves. And we say it in our vision statement, where we say we are an incubator for the next generation of UUs, fostering spiritual and ethical exploration tailored to age and stage and promoting intergenerational unity. So, an incubator for the next generation of UUs. And I take a broad view, actually, of this next generation of UUs. I believe it includes children, yes, but adults as well. As new UUs join us, they too become the next generation, along with the children who we raise. The next generation of UUs is always growing, and we want to provide that sort of incubation for all ages because we want to see our values expressed more and more in the world. I once heard of a teen who had grown up through UURE, and he was kind of downplaying what he had gotten out of it. Nothing special, he said. We looked at tadpoles and walked in the woods and played non-competitive games and built stuff and heard stories. But we need to contextualize that nothing special. I began my career as an educator, so I know something about different kinds of curriculum. And one way of explaining what we teach is to talk about explicit, implicit, and null curriculum. So explicitly, here at UUFM, we teach a cycle of three basic units: Unitarian Universalism, Bible stories, and world religions. So when a child comes through religious education here, we expect that they will know something about Unitarian Universalism. They'll recognize some culturally common Bible stories and know something about the various religions of the world. And I remember a young, like a nine-year-old in a congregation I served before, who her friends were talking about Lent and what they were giving up, but they didn't have any idea what it was about, so she explained Lent to them because she had learned it in religious education. Anyway, but our children do know the UU principles, and if you're not sure of them yourself, ask one of our children to sing the song they do every week, and they can tell you our principles. And if they've gone through some of our whole lives curriculum, which is an extremely valuable curriculum, we hope that they will also know basic. Christopher's back there. Yay! They'll know basic facts about sex as well as how communication and relationships and safety relate to sexual behavior. But the implicit curriculum, the unstated messages that are carried by how we teach, are at least as important as what we teach. We prioritize our children's questions. We invite engagement rather than passive listening. We encourage them to say how they think and feel about what's under discussion. And this is really the stuff that Channing talked about back in the 19th century. Because it is implicit, the people experiencing that kind of education, like the teen I talked about earlier, may not be able to articulate it. They may not even know it's happening, but it's still a deep shaper. So we are teaching our children, and maybe our adults as well, as much about how to think about religion as we are teaching about religion per se. We're also hoping to convey the message of our principles, that they have inherent worth and dignity. And so does everyone around them. We hope they see values like justice and equity and compassion demonstrated in the classroom and in the fellowship itself. We hope that democracy, a voice and a vote for everyone, shows up to them and to us in how our fellowship operates. We hope the interdependent web of existence, of all existence, comes alive for them in classroom explorations and through their activities. And all this comes from implicit curriculum, from how we present what we present. And finally, there's the null curriculum, what is not taught. And for many parents here, that may be as important as anything that is taught. We do not teach children that they are sinners or inherently evil. And some of you may have learned that in religious settings. We do not teach that there's any particular belief system they need to adopt in order to be whole, holy, or acceptable. We do not teach children or adults specific beliefs they ought to hold about God or Jesus or Buddha, though we do acquaint them with ideas that people have had and have and invite them to consider their own ideas. So education is a value, and I would even say progressive education is a value. And a lot of becoming UU is simply being part of a UU congregation and reflecting on your experience and growing into that identity. And that is true whether you are 2 years old or 10 or 30 or 70. Now, our educational process really focuses on that factor that I mentioned earlier, that what matters is how we live in this life rather than what we believe or working toward another life. So how we teach matters as much as what we teach. And finally, if how we live matters rather than what we believe, I have to come to living out our values in the world. Covenant, education, and finally, action. The Oklahoma folk singer Woody Guthrie said, "Religion is to forget yourself and work for the good of others. Outside of that, there is no religion." Work for the good of others. Work for the good of the world. In normal times, I would say something here about Theodore Parker, the Unitarian minister from this morning's story, and the arc of the moral universe bending toward justice. I would talk about how Unitarians and Universalists have always been in the forefront of justice movements, abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, progressive education, improved care for physical and mental health, prison reform, kindergarten, birth control, civil rights, the Equal Rights Amendment, LGBTQ plus rights, environmental justice, equal marriage. I might mention that sometimes we were misled and worked for causes that would prove themselves problematic, but that more often than not, those misdirections corrected themselves as we learned more. We had a lot of temperance supporters. I would say all that if we were in normal times. But I'm not sure that we are. Now, human progress continues at such a pace that it's hard for people to compensate for the speed of change, and so much that has brought us progress has contributed to the climate change that threatens the existence of the species and even our own existence. In the wake of that, resource allocation is inequitable, so people around the globe are more and more dislocated, suffer drought, other weather devastation. We are terribly challenged in these times. And here, in a country we like to think of as civilized, we're at each other's throats and even literally killing each other. Last week we had more news of devastating mass shootings. I'm reading and seeing more and more contemplation around the idea of how do we keep going? How do we keep doing good when we encounter so much decidedly not good? You use as optimistic as our view of human beings are challenged by mass shootings, yes, but also by climate change, by partisan deadlock, by the increasing visibility of racism, patriarchy, and white supremacy. And many of us are devastated and many of us are exhausted. So, to all of this, I offer this meditation by UU Minister Ann Barker titled, When the Unimaginable Happens. When we heard the news, saw the wreckage, felt the paralyzing blow, our hearts broke open and spilled out into our hands. And there we were watching our love seep between our fingers, watching our fragile love pour out all over us, watching our love seem to slip away. When the unimaginable happened, the ache that we felt as if love was being lost was the ache of love's despairing truth. This is the love that no one chooses, the loss so out of order, so profound, the love we did not ever want to know. And yet the source of this despair, the reason our hearts cleave and flow, is because they know fullness. This is the love of truth and beauty, love that spans the web of being, uniting each of us within its timeless form. When we heard the news, our hearts broke open, spilled into our hands, and there we stared at love, lamenting, "What am I to do with this?" And with these raw and tender yearnings, we will beat after precious beat seek wholeness again. It will take time to find our balance, to grieve if we will make room. Remember, friends, this is the right thing, this ache within our deepest beings. Know that all these things are normal to feel disrupted, empty, or undone. Our hearts broke open, and the love that is still true draws us once again together, story by story, step by step, into places of tender knowing, remembering to restore us, mend us, piece by broken piece. This is the love that runs between us, sustaining force of restoration, the love that nourishes and feeds us, binds us each to our collective core. We grieve and march and weep and sing, and through the pain, but not despite it, love will repair us. Not the same, but stronger in some places, honoring memories like treasures, living out our lives' potential in the shadow of the trespass, in the warmth of one another, in the light of what restored we will become. Reverend Barker tells us that love will repair us. And this is such an important reassurance that so many of us are craving now. Because here is the secret I have learned about action in the world. Yes, it matters how we live in the world. But no, it's not about the results. What really matters is how we live, in how we live, is that we live in such a way that we champion the values deepest to our hearts, whatever happens. If we live that way, then we end up happier, healthier, and in better relationship with ourselves, our families, and other people out and beyond into the world. We live better lives. Does it make the world better? Does it help other people? I hope so. But whatever the results, I do believe it is what we are called to do, what we must do to live in accord with our values and principles. And I think that's what Natalie Fenimore was talking about when she talked about loving a Unitarian Universalism that does not yet exist. We keep working to bring these values into being, and in the same way, we have to love a world that does not yet exist, that may not ever exist, even for our children or for our grandchildren. And nevertheless, we keep trying to make it better because it is worth it. As 19th century Universalist minister Olympia Brown said, to work for a great and true principle without counting the cost. So may it be. We have about 5 minutes or so if there is anything that came up for you in our, as you were listening passively. I caught that I was saying, talking about the importance of our children not listening passively as I was inviting you all to listen passively. There is an irony.
Sabrina Volker, I was thinking about how I was waiting for the end of the world concerning global warming, but you know how everybody, I just told you about how if everybody on the planet just cut their meat consumption by like maybe 25% or something, but that, you know, that would actually help kick it into the right direction. But I was thinking about how I was sitting there, I was like, oh, I can't do anything, I'll just have to wait for the inevitable, but I can do something, and I know how, just tell the Dalai Lama and the Pope, and those two can, if they say, yeah, I do that, then that the Dalai Lama, everybody respects him, and the Pope is like, oh, there's a billion Catholics, so that's a billion people there. But also, I was thinking about when you were talking about the turtle, and I was like thinking about myself looking at the turtle. I sit by the turtle and look at the turtle and just relaxing and just enjoying the fact the turtle's sitting there looking at me. He's like, oh, what are you doing here? I'm just sitting by you. But yeah, it's a. I shouldn't be sitting passively. I should be. You're right. We do not believe we move, and I should start moving more. So, and not just getting out and talking to other people like I'm going to do in Syracuse, but you know, moving more. So, thank you for that inspirational. What the hell is it called here? Whatever. Talk. Okay, I'll say talk. But anyway, yeah. Thank you.
Sarah, with the turtle story, that was a beautiful connection because I have trouble finding my conscience sometimes. I thought of the Native American tradition, turtles all the way down, that the the universe, the planet, is a turtle on the back of a turtle, on the back of a turtle, on the back of a turtle. And that has always, I've thought about the interdependence that growth and individuality at the same time have.
Well, in the litany of terrible, things happening, certainly the shootings are there, but the raids in Mississippi just tear one's heart out. And so here we sit. How do we live in this 1 hour? And it occurred to me that we did something right in our offering. That Flint Hills Community Clinic is a step towards justice right here at home. The way we're going to talk to one another over the next half hour as we have coffee and such, we're going to live or fail to live up to treating others as people of dignity. And that is the kind of daily living of our values that help us grow. So thank you.
I just wanted to say thanks for helping very much, I mean, remind or teach or, I don't know what, us and me, that, you know, our hearts hurt, right? As the poem said, our hearts hurt because of the love that we have, right? And the value is having that love. Like, I want to be a person who is sorely troubled, right, by what's going on in the world, right? And it's so easy when so much is happening to try to kind of inure yourself and step away and mm-hmm. kind of shut down, because it's really hard to feel that all the time. But mm-hmm. it's really important to feel that's we have to, right? And so this is helpful for me to keep on feeling, right, the pain at the injustices in the world that are especially happening right now, and keep myself open to feeling that pain, because it's so important to see what's happening and to know why it's wrong.
Encouragement, that's good. Our closing hymn, I need to tell you a little bit about, because the words are changed. Number 1017 in the Teal Book says standing on the side of love. But the composer changed it to answering the call of love because there were people who had physical disabilities who said we're not comfortable with standing on the side of love. And he said, well, we need to change this. We need to be more inclusive. And so everything in the book is right except standing. When it says standing on the side of love, we'll try to say answering the call of love. And the words that are up here will be correct. So if you get confused, look up here. If you say something that somebody else isn't saying, don't worry about it. We do that all the time, say things that other people aren't saying. We're fine with it. So answering the call of love, I invite you to rise in body or spirit.
The promise of the Spirit, faith, hope, and love abide. So every soul is blessed, made whole. The truth in our hearts is our guide. We are answering the call.
words of 19th century Universalist Olympia Brown, stand by this faith. Work for it and sacrifice for it. There is nothing in all the world so important as to be loyal to the faith which has placed before us the loftiest ideals. Do not demand immediate results, but rejoice that we are worthy to be entrusted with this great message, that you are strong enough to work for a great true principle without counting the cost. Go on finding ever new applications of these truths and new enjoyments in their contemplation, always trusting in the one God which ever lives and loves.